Chapter 2, Mirpur Camps. I was beginning to wonder if it would make any difference to tour any more camps. The Mirpur camps were as squalid as those in Mohammadpur. How I describe one could apply to all of them. No, said Muhammad Sunullah Khan, one of the leaders of Mirpur branch camp. Actually, the camps of Mohammadpur and Mirpur are the better camps. Although it was after 8 at night, there were still dozens of young boys working on looms, weaving the highly prized and expensive Banaras silk saris. The sheds where they worked were dimly lit by kerosene lamps. As we moved in, Khan said, "We get paid 10 takas a sari. That ends up selling in the shops for 9,000 takas and up." Khan, with a degree in chemistry, had been a laboratory assistant before 1971, but he now sold cloth made in the camp. I had seen a good deal of enterprise in the camps that at least allowed the Biharis to subsist on more than rations of a handful of rice or grain, which were distributed once a month by the Bangladesh Red Crescent Society to each adult over 16. Like the over 40,000 in Mohammadpur camps, the more than 38,000 in the Mirpur camps depended on 2 pumps for their entire water supply. I watched as hundreds lined up to get water from pumps that were only on a short time, early in the morning and for 1 hour at night. Geneva camp had 18 primitive brick latrines. Mirpur branch camp had none. There were a few houses in this camp complex, but they were crumbling so badly they were not any better than the makeshift bamboo, plastic, and newspaper-lined huts. The roofs of the houses I went into had long ago caved in. Corrugated tin now served as the roofs. All of the houses I entered looked dangerously near collapse. The back portions of most had already caved in. Finally, we crowded into the small Mirpur branch camp headquarters. Not all was unrelenting misery. This was one of the delightful moments when conversation was casual and pleasant. There was banter back and forth about some of the funnier happenings of camp life. One man, Faizullah Khan, began to relate how they slip out at night and carry buckets of excretion. We dispose of it by dumping it in front of houses around the neighborhood. There was a sudden pause that seemed to abruptly cut off conversation. The air itself became still. There was a strange pressure that brought an odd feeling of strain. Did they all feel it too, or was it just me? No. They gazed at me with expressions that showed great concern, as if they all knew what it meant. Then an abrupt swoop of hot, dry air sucked up through the bamboo hut. Dust burst in, swirling around, enveloping us so swiftly it was like sandpaper brushing against bare skin. I had been taking notes, and my paper was covered with dust. My smarting eyes closed, and my hands went instinctively over my mouth and nose. "Welcome to Bangladesh, land of cyclones," came the calm voice of Faizullah Khan from somewhere in the room. Cyclone. Then came the explosive burst of wind, cloud, thunder, and down came rain in heavy sheets, like a waterfall pouring over the palm leaf roofing. Soon the dust had cleared, and I could open my eyes. The hut groaned and swayed under those violent winds and rains, and I would not have been surprised if, like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, that at any moment we'd be picked up, hut and all, and carried off by winds that had to have been 100 miles an hour or more. But it was only part of the roof that the wind ripped off and carried away, and beneath us at least 4 feet of water came rushing in, forcing us to cling to a bench or table. After the worst of the storm passed and the water below us receded, we waded out into the black, drizzling night, slipping, sinking down into the mud. A house in the camp collapsed, trapping a mother and 4 children inside. The unreal night was passed digging them out. The mother was brought out uninjured. 2 of her sons, aged 10 and 11, were pulled out with possible broken bones. The search continued for 2 little ones. A tiny, limp hand was felt under the pile of gravel the walls of the house had become. The frantic digging was too late. The 3-year-old girl, and then her 7-year-old brother, had smothered under the gravel. A mysterious ambulance suddenly appeared, whisking away the 2 older, uninjured boys. The mother screamed, frantically racing after the ambulance as it sped away. By the time we reached the mother, the ambulance was gone, and she was muttering, "Ambulances don't come here. Why have they taken my children?" It was only later that we would know why. Shahid and I needed a place to wait out what was left of the dark, grueling night. We waded through the mud until we reached the road at the edge of the camp. Although all of Dhaka was without power, I could make out that we had entered a prosperous neighborhood of two-story homes. The road was rain-slicked, but not flooded, and the walk was easy as I followed Shahid's lead. I had no idea where we were going, but he seemed to have a destination in mind. Was it the main road, in hopes of finding transport back to the hotel? The Hotel Nidmahal in Sukrabad was our legal residence during our stay in Bangladesh. It could be described as a fifth-rate hotel, four stories high. Compared to the Bihari camps, it was luxury. We used the hotel mostly to store our excess belongings and to pop in and out from time to time, but the prospects of getting back there seemed doubtful in the aftermath of a cyclone and at this early hour of the morning. Unlike Karachi, a city that never seems to sleep, the Dhaka I had seen so far closes down by nightfall. The pavement on the road suddenly ended. I got a glimpse of where the road appeared to have been scooped away. The pavement then resumed on the other side of a two-story house as lightning briefly illuminated the surroundings. It was to this house, across the gouged road, through an expanse of deep mud, that Shahid led me. We reached the bottom of partially collapsed cement stairs. We scrambled up 4 feet of crumbling concrete to reach the remaining stairs that led to the entrance of the house. Once inside, we began the ascent up a cracked, uneven, enclosed spiral stairwell in pitch darkness toward the second floor. I heard squeals of rodents, and I stifled the impulse to scream when something crawled over my hand as I pressed my palm for guidance against the rough wall. Shahid flicked on his lighter, and that was when I realized the entire stairwell was swarming with rats, and the walls were covered with cockroaches the size of fists. A gasp escaped from my throat before I could trap it. I may have remained calm during the cyclone and its aftermath, but this was the stuff of nightmares, being enclosed in the dark with swarms of rats, hissing and squealing as they scurried away from the light. Shahid's grin brought me out of that momentary frozen panic. Now I felt stupid as I took a deep breath for courage and forced myself to continue up the stairs. "How do you feel about snakes?" he asked me impishly. Now I saw one, too, slithering just a few steps ahead. "Is it poisonous?" I asked. "Not this one." Then I shrugged and had no problem passing across it. Finally, we reached the second floor and walked down a long veranda. We came to a doorway where a shabby curtain was hung. Shahid tapped at the doorframe and called out. We could hear nervous whispering inside, then a large man peeked out, shining a lantern on us. Although it had been 12 years since the man had seen Shahid, he recognized him at once. I learned immediately that this was Shahid's maternal uncle, as he gruffly greeted him, and we were invited to come inside. We were now in two rooms, where the man, his wife, and 5 children lived. Other families now shared the remainder of the house that prior to 1971 was occupied only by his family and servants. This was once a fine house, but all these years without repairs was turning it into a crumbling ruin. The rooms, with plaster cracking and peeling from every wall, were cluttered and dusty. While he and his family appeared to be better off than those in the makeshift huts or collapsing houses of the camps, there was the same sense of danger. 3 pieces of furniture took up most of the floor space in these 2 rooms. There were 2 large 4-poster beds and a wooden cabinet, filled to capacity with what was left of their treasured possessions and books. Now I learned that some Biharis were allowed to remain in their homes in Mirpur, and all lived under the same conditions. "Did you see how they hacked away the road in front of the house?" he asked bitterly. In 1978, General Ziaur Rahman ordered the army to come and evict all Biharis who were still in their homes and move us to the camps. The army pushed 1,000 families from their homes to the camps, but a few sued in the courts and were able to return to their houses. Although they were back in their homes, the roads in front were torn out, the water, electrical, and gas lines were closed off. And municipal tankers won't come and drain out the cesspools, nor do we have a way to dispose of garbage, except to dump it outside the house. He said they were able to pirate some electricity by connecting a wire to a nearby power pole. Shahid's uncle was once the manager of a luxury hotel, as well as running several small businesses. He had not been able to get a job since 1971 and lost all the businesses. They lived for years by gradually selling off belongings and renting other portions of the house. Some money came from their adult son and daughter who had made it to Pakistan. Recently, he said, his 18-year-old son had finally gotten a job as a bellboy in the same hotel he had once managed. A 16-year-old son sat quietly beside him and seemed to be ill and in pain. I finally got a doctor to examine him, but then I couldn't get the prescription for the medicine filled. He showed me the prescription, which had a notation at the left-hand corner, Bihari. There was no need for him to elaborate any further. At dawn, his 5-year-old daughter and 10-year-old son were dressed in their uniforms and heading for school. Although he was still able to get the younger ones into primary school, they would be forced to study privately at home to further their education after the 6th grade. His 16-year-old had completed high school with private studies, but with failing health expressed worry whether he could go on. It was through private studies that his 18-year-old son completed his college education, but the degree in engineering did not get him a job except as a bellboy. There are no real jobs for most Biharis, so I don't see much of a future for my children here, the man said. And as he spoke, he held his 3-month-old daughter on his lap. This was a family that had never registered with the ICRC as Pakistanis. This was, in fact, a family with Bangladesh citizenship. At the first light of dawn, we left to return to Mirpur Branch Camp for the funerals of the 2 children who died during the cyclone. And it was in the light of day that the contrast of this house and those in the surrounding neighborhood became apparent. The neighboring houses were well kept and with paved road running in front of them. But Shahid's uncle's house stood out like a festering sore. The trash and garbage and the overflowing cesspool spilled into the mud that had once been the street. We now arrived at the camp. I squeezed through dozens of weeping women who had come to give condolences to the mother of the 2 children who were killed during the cyclone. Just as I reached the mother to offer my condolences, she swooned into a faint. A short time later, I joined Shahid, where the 2 dead children were laid out on the ground, wrapped in the traditional shrouds. But as the men began to carry off the bodies for burial, an ambulance pulled up a distance away, dumped 2 plastic bags out of the rear door, and sped off. When the plastic bags were brought back and opened, I stood staring in disbelief. There were the bodies of the 2 boys. Now I understood the mother's panic when her sons had been taken away, as I heard resigned murmurs from the men gathered around. Here it's open season on Biharis. The funeral that started with 2 and ended with 4 was over. There were uniformed police all over the camp in large numbers today. After the emotions of the morning, I needed some time to sit in quiet and write some notes while events were still fresh in my mind. I settled down in the rickshaw parked at the edge of camp. There were little shops on one side. It looked like a typical working-class neighborhood bazaar, with stalls selling tea, cigarettes, betel leaf, and sweets. There were both Bengalis and stranded Pakistanis strolling on that narrow, unpaved road. Children began to come out of the camp. They headed straight to me, and soon had surrounded the rickshaw. "That's my friend from America," said one small girl. "I held her hand and took her all round last night." The other children round her began to shake their heads. "She didn't hold your hand," scoffed one. "She did too." And to prove it, she moved closer and implored, "You did, didn't you?" I reached outside the rickshaw and took her hand. "Yes, just like that. And I remember, your name is Sumina." A boy squeezed in. "Your Urdu is funny," he giggled. "And you don't have good manners," Sumina chastised him. "Well," the boy responded, "she looks Pakistani, but talks funny." Bengali teenagers and younger children had now stopped. For a while, they just watched, but then one boy moved in closer and called out in English, "You Pakistani?" "No, American." "Speak Bangla?" "No." "I learned English in school," he said proudly. "Are you a missionary?" "No." I was beginning to get concerned about the large mix of children from the camp and the gathering of Bengali children, but they didn't seem to mind one another. The children eventually drifted away as I paid less attention to them and concentrated on writing down a brief description of the neighborhood behind the bazaar. It was definitely working class, not middle class. The houses were small, uniform, and most likely were bottom-ranked government or factory workers' quarters. Later, Shahid, who had been in this camp, confirmed that these were quarters for factory employees, and that those simple but comfortable homes had been home to many now in the camp. As the morning waned and the day was warming up, the ground that had been a rusty red had begun to dry and was now back to its beige color. And as I noted that description of the natural landscape, a young man in a crisp white button-down shirt, wearing a plaid lungi, a pleated wrap worn by those in Bengal, came over to the rickshaw. "Good morning," he said, in perfect polished English. I glanced up at the handsome, swarthy young man. He looked to be in his mid-teens, but his voice was deep and mature. "Good morning," I replied. He ran his hand over his glossy, perfectly trimmed hair. "So, you're the journalist visiting the camps?" "I'm a tourist, just looking around." His eyes shifted toward the camp, then back to me. "You see how we're forced to live in these camps," I said, but in Urdu this time, "Bahat buri halat." He returned a blank look, and it was obvious he spoke no Urdu, and therefore could not possibly be from the camp. For a second he lost his composure, then quickly regaining it, said, "Well, goodbye. Have a nice visit." Nurul Islam, who had been standing a short distance away, came over as soon as the young man had walked off. "What is he, secret police?" I laughed. "Probably. Not one of us, for sure." Nurul wiped off a trickle of sweat from his brow. Not long after that, a uniformed policeman arrived. "This isn't the best place for you to sit here alone," he said curtly. "I have the rickshaw driver with me," I replied. "My nephew's gone off taking pictures somewhere." "I want to see your passport." "You may, though I don't know why." I took it out of my purse and handed it to him. "American?" he asked after studying each and every page. "Yes." "Tourist visa. You need a journalist visa." "I'm not a reporter." "Have you registered with the police?" "Yes." I took out the papers and showed them to him. "You have round-trip airline tickets?" "Of course I have. Want to see them?" "You came from Pakistan before coming here?" "Yes, and I'll be going back the same way." "Have family there?" "Yes, my husband's family." "Any of them in the military?" "No." "Any family here?" "No." "So why did you come here?" "Just like to travel and see new places." Finally, he returned my passport. "Well, enjoy your stay. Only be careful. We're in the middle of elections, and there could be trouble." Nurul and I both heaved a collective sigh of relief when the officer finally left. Soon after, Shahid returned, and we headed back to the hotel for a needed break before going to the more remote camps on the outskirts of Dhaka.